Art Scene Radio Talk Show.
Welcome to episode 5 of the Arts, the Art Scene Radio Talk Show. I'm your host, Radman.
And this is the Tuscan Racer.
Today's date is Sunday, June 13th, 2004. For those of you joining us for the very first time, The Arts is a variety talk show dedicated to the scene, including graphics, demos, tracking, and all things in between. So, Spinsane.
Yes.
Welcome back.
Thanks, my brother. It's been a long couple of weeks, and I'm glad to see that you did an episode without me, and Anthem, props to you because you did a good job.
You weren't able to join us in episode 4. What happened?
Well, I've had a lot of things going on in my personal life. I've been committed to a loony bin, basically, and I'm about to get medication. Until this all clears, I'll be kind of off the wall.
Well, that should make for exciting radio.
Yeah, it should. I should be nuts, but I'm not. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens.
This is a special episode. We're all enjoying our choice beverages tonight.
Yeah, I'm drinking a couple of Yingling lagers.
Yingling lagers.
That's correct.
I'm not familiar with that.
It's a local brewery in Tampa, Florida, from the Busch Gardens stable of stuff, Anheuser-Busch, I guess.
Okay. Every episode, you know, we make a point of saying that this isn't something that's regularly scheduled, and we really want to drive that message home that we do this as often as we can. We enjoy putting the show together for everybody. Don't even know where I'm going with this, but...
Right.
But, you know, if we could do this every day, we would. But unfortunately, time constraints won't permit that. In this show, we have a couple things to discuss. We're going to have Legalized, the main organizer of the Pilgrimage Demo Party, as a guest on our show. There are many current events going on in the scene. There's some new magazines that have been coming out.
Damn. Really? All this information is new to me. Say more, say more.
Well, okay. Before I jump into the current events that we have to cover, I do have a couple emails. We have an email here from Spliff Monk. Basically, the synopsis of this is that he really enjoys the show. He particularly enjoyed the interview that we had with Blackjack from Mimic, and it really motivated him to get him involved more heavily with ASCII art.
That's what I hear. Actually, I found Spliff Monk on Pound ASCII on EFNet, or FNet, as you said, and I actually did some Pablo drawing with him. Thanks to the arts, I guess we have more people trying to draw ASCII art, which is just great. I enjoy it completely.
Yeah.
Again, a lot of the channels where people who draw low-resolution or text mode art on FNet are #ANS, #ANSI, ANSI, #ASCII, and it was great to see someone new come into the forum and attempt to draw with me. I really enjoyed it. It was cool.
Did you happen to catch what country Spliff Monk was originating from?
No, I didn't catch what country he was coming from, unfortunately. I'm going to assume the United States. He just seemed like he was from the United States. A lot of the times, the people from Scandinavia or Northern Europe, where a lot of the other ASCII art people come from, have more of a background in it. So I kind of felt like he was from the United States, but that's just a guesstimate on my part. But I did draw with him, and we completed a piece, and I actually have a Spliff Monk ASCII piece coming out in Remorse 54, which should be released very soon.
Very cool. I didn't print off all of our emails that we've received, but I did print off one other from Maiden Man of Tap. He just mentioned that he really enjoys our shows. He's listened to all of our episodes, beginning from episode 1. And that, you know, he really appreciates the fact that usually we speak fairly clearly. And he also mentioned that he really enjoys living in Europe and the fact that he's able to attend so many parties very easily. It looks like he's going to be attending like half a dozen parties by the end of this year.
Yeah, I saw that email you forwarded to me, and he said he was going to attend like half a dozen, like you said, demo parties in the near future. And I think that's awesome that our radio show in English translates so well to people who English may not be the first language. And
right.
I guess I'm glad our English is solid enough for him to understand it, because I know I will not understand Norwegian or another language if it is spoken to me. So.
And that's why I asked if you happen to, like, through jointing with Spliff Monk, if you happen to catch what country is originating from, because a large chunk of our listenership originates from the Russian Federation and Hungary and not surprisingly Germany, but I was kind of surprised at Hungary.
Right.
France is also fairly high up there, but the number one country right now for the arts, this isn't for the entire acid site, but for the arts in particular, Hungary is the leading non-English speaking country.
You know what's interesting about that is actually, I don't know, I know you're also a fan of the Hacker Radio internet shows, and Binary Revolution also shows their statistics like once a month
right.
on their radio show, and Hungary ends up being one of the major listeners to that as well. And I know, I don't know very much about Hungary, but I do know that their scene in Hungary is very relevant to the rest of the scene, if you know what I'm talking about.
Right, right.
Excuse me. Hungary is very important to the rest of the European, North American scene and the worldwide scene, so it's kind of interesting that they're all listening to our radio shows. I find that very fortunate. It's cool. Does that make any sense to you? Hungary, let me just say, Hungary has sights, if you will.
Okay, no? Sure. Okay? I see the direction that you're going.
Yeah, okay, there you go. That's all I need to say. The routing is good.
Yes, you've opened up my eyes. Thank you. In the magazine news, a new issue of Grapevine magazine has been released. Grapevine was originally a legendary Amiga disc mag, which has since been revived and brought to the web. So when we say issue 2, I think that's referring issue 2 on the web. As far as I understand, they've put out, you know, probably 20 or 30 issues when they were doing the Amiga disc mag coded. And so now they've moved on to the web-based magazine.
What's the URL for that?
The Grapevine issues can be found at www.lsde.org, and that is spelled ELLESDEE.org.
Okay.
And so there you'll find issue 1 and 2 for now, and 3 is underway.
Yeah.
There was a very interesting article that I think anybody, even if you're not involved in the Amiga scene, would find interesting, and that is from Phoenix of Hornet. Phoenix of Hornet wrote an article regarding the upcoming Mind Candy Volume 2.
Oh, yeah.
Which is on track to be released by the end of this year.
What exactly is Mind Candy 2?
Mind Candy Volume 2, well, as probably everybody knows, Mind Candy Volume 1 was a compilation of some of the best old school and new school demos on the IBM PC. And to follow up with that, they're going to be releasing Volume 2, hopefully by the end of this year, which is going to focus on the Amiga demos. I believe they've published a list of the demos that they're actually going to be featuring, and they're looking to make contact with coders to get rights clearances to put certain demos that they want to have and that the public wants to see on this release.
Right.
So definitely check this out. You can check it out with any web browser, and you can check out that article and see who they're looking to contact. And if you can help these folks out, I'm sure everybody will be pretty happy to see these particular demos featured on the DVD. Just as Phoenix said in his own article, now that Mind Candy 1 has come out, it's kind of invigorated the PC scene, and it's kind of bringing awareness to the scene. It's making it easy enough where that anybody with a DVD player and a projection screen and a sound system can just go anywhere and start showing demos without having to recreate the specific hardware requirements that were necessary at the time to view the demo properly.
Right.
And so, you know, now you can go to galleries and computer conferences and art shows and different types of shows and what have you, and people can just show off Mind Candy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that same effect will happen, I'm sure, with Volume 2.
Okay.
So what else is going on? There's some new releases in the ASCII scene, or the text mode scene.
Yes, there have been quite a few since the last time we spoke. I don't believe the Arts number 4 really touched on that subject. I do know that there's been a few releases since then. Mimic, of course, released their June pack. Actually, I think it was their May pack.
Right, it was released a little bit late, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, it was really, like, Blackjack seemed to have caught the Arts number 3 curse, or, well, not the number 3, but the number 2, which he was featured in Curse, and they were not able to release on time, which is rare for them. But that's okay, because Mimic did release an ASCII pack. They did get a new member, Halifax.
Okay, yeah, Halifax.
Yeah, Halifax is good. He draws some old-school style ASCII, and he's actually trying to create his new magazine, which is called Kitchen Sink.
Kitchen Sink. Now, is that going to be a coded magazine, or is it just going to be a straight ASCII magazine?
I believe it's going to be a straight ASCII magazine. I don't have much information about it right now, but I do have the URL if anyone is interested.
Yeah.
It's www.oddboy.serverpro3.com/ks/.
What kind of URL is that?
It's obviously one that he hosts himself and is trying to make stuff go with.
I'm checking it out right now, and it looks like it is going to, in fact, be a coded magazine with variable font sets. So it's going to support Amiga fonts, PC fonts, and as well as EGA 80x43 and 80x50 50-line mode fonts as well.
That should be coming out soon. So
very cool.
Another group that's making waves, supposedly, is Ricky Martin, who has emailed us previously on the show. He was also previously in Mimic and Remorse, which is my group and your group as well, but he's formed his own group, Penis. So they should be releasing soon. Let me check my notes here. 27 Inch, which is an ANSI group.
Now wait, you just went from Penis to 27 Inch?
Yeah. Does that seem kind of weird? Does it scare you? I don't know. But 27 Inch has been an ANSI group that's been around for 4 years now. They have only put out a few packs. They're not bi-monthly, semi-monthly, quarterly, or anything, but they did just put out a new pack. They also have a new ASCII division in their group, which is called SARS, as in the disease, which includes Nocturnal, Spear, I think Aesthetic, really some. I was talking to them tonight about the new release of SARS. I guess SARS is going to be attempting to take over the ASCII scene from Mimic and Remorse, but we'll see what happens. But
I know this sounds...
Go ahead.
Well, I was saying, I know this sounds sort of hypocritical coming from the guy who has an ASCII group that is kind of a subsidiary of what was originally an ANSI group, but at this point in time, I really don't understand why an ANSI group needs to have an ASCII group subdivision or vice versa, because there are so many similarities and the difference is so negligible, it's so minimal.
Well, I especially agree with you there, Radman, because especially with 27 Inch, which isn't one of the bigger groups in the ANSI scene, admittedly, they do have some of the better artists. They do release a good pack. They do have most of the good artists, but they release it like once every 3 to 4 months, if not more. Where they get off doing an ASCII subgroup,
yes.
I don't understand it at all, especially since there are, I mean, not even just Mimic and Remorse. There's Impure. There's a couple of Russian ASCII groups that I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but it just seems like a weird kind of narcissistic thing to do. But whatever, I'm going to kick their ass.
Okay. Well, I'm taking a look right now at 27-inch pack number 7.
Right.
It's pretty cool. I see one of the better ANSIs was also, I believe, jointed in the last TNT pack, right? The one with Enzo, the Spider-Man, and...
Tell you what, let me go look at it.
Yeah.
You know? Because which ASCII are you looking at?
This is the one with Enzo and Aesthetic.
Was it the Spider-Man one?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Well, that's pretty much, I think, the best.
I do think...
No. Okay, I'm sorry. This is Sense in 27-inch. So, yeah,
okay.
I'm taking a look at it now, and it's... is that right? Yeah. Sense in 27-inch.
It was. It was the Aesthetic and the Enzo piece.
Yeah.
And it was the one that Aesthetic got pissed off at you because you didn't recognize him for drawing it.
That's a great picture, dude.
Yeah, it is.
And then I'm also looking at another really killer piece here. What is this? 911?
I'm looking as well. Okay, that's beautiful. The Avenging Angel. 911.
It kind of, the shading style really reminds me of Eerie.
It kind of reminds me of Iodine, but that's just me.
Iodine, huh? You know, it's reminiscent of Eerie. It's not, like, directly Eerie, but if Eerie were to try and do this style as far as the picture goes, I mean, he never was really much of a comic book ripper, but,
right.
Man, this is great.
The picture looks like Eerie.
Yeah, exactly.
But, like, the shading and the shaping and, like, the coloring and stuff kind of reminds me of Iodine. What do I know? I'm an ASCII artist, so.
It's a great piece. Regardless, right?
Yeah, it's good. It was a good pack.
In other news, Lord Scarlet, the coder of the Idle Dreams archive, which is pretty much the only ANSI archive online that's very comprehensive. It has a search engine which you can go through and search by file name or artist, or it goes through and does keyword searches for any ANSI that's been released
ever.
That's
right.
It has the entire Dark Domain DVD integrated into its archive, so it basically has at your fingertips ANSI's that go back to 1987 up until present day. And they've since moved over to 16colors.net. They're changing names, and they're changing their name and getting a facelift.
Yeah, I don't know why he's switching the domain name, but I give him props for it. I've checked it out, and it's coming along nicely. And if anyone wants to actually donate, you can do that at 16colors.net. It's spelled out. There's no numbers in that. He's really doing a very good job, especially since the Idle Dreams days. Seems like he's making the site much more searchable, etc.
Right. From what I understand, what he's looking to do, the reason that there's now 16colors.net and formerly Idle Dreams, is
right.
He's looking to have some sort of a separation between Idle Dreams and 16colors.net, so that 16colors is the ANSI library, the ANSI archive, and then Idle Dreams is more of like a personal blog or some sort of more or less a personal site for himself.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that. So.
And it looks like he's taken off the registration... forced registration. You remember when he first put it up, you had to register your name?
Yeah, when he first put up the website, you had to register to search for ANSI on it, but he took that off recently, so. He still needs donations. I donated $5 to him. Like, that was a long time ago, but he's doing a good thing for the scene, so.
Right, like we said, he's the only site like this. He's running the only site of this kind for the ANSI scene and the ASCII scene, so if you appreciate this site, and you have the means, you know, available to donate, then absolutely, please do that and help support this site. And
I guess you're not running a site anymore?
Not at this time.
Back in the day, there were like three or four sites that did this, but
right.
Not exactly like this. Like, you couldn't search. The difference between his site and arttax.asa.org was in this one, you can search for specific artists and specific years and stuff and like find packs, whereas artpacks.asa.org.
You can only search by file name.
Right.
And this is a much more comprehensive search engine where you can just drill down to the artist.
I hope he gets it working.
Yeah, it's
okay.
A great site. And there it is. If you go there, you can just scroll right down and PayPal donate right away.
Right.
I'm getting a message from Legalize right now.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, from Pilgrimage. And he wants us to add him in, so we can go ahead and do that.
Okay, let's do it.
All right. There it is. We have Legalize on the phone. He is the Pilgrimage organizer. He's organizing this year's Pilgrimage Demo Party, which is taking place in Salt Lake City, Utah. He has been organizing this is going to be the second year running. It is the only demo party that is taking place in all of Northern America. And we were speaking earlier, before he joined the show, regarding some of the historical events that took place locally in his own town that are used today in present-day demo coding, such as Goro shading and Fong shading, and several other techniques that we see used today in demos today. I was just wondering if you could explain some of the effects that you see today used in current-day demos and how they where they got started.
Why don't you, explain them and, like, how they're relevant to the present. Like, you know, those effects, Radman, if you can.
Thanks,
what
dude.
What the fuck? Fuck you! Dude, you mean you just like pull out effects like grunge shading or whatever the fuck, and it's like, no one knows what that is.
Everybody knows what that is that's listening to that part.
I know all the demo coders know what that is, man. But
well,
like,
he'll explain that, dude.
I'm talking to ASCII kids. Okay, I'll shut my mouth. Okay.
No, you're right.
I don't want to explain it more.
Okay, yeah. No, Spin Thane's absolutely right. Not everybody knows what Goro shading is. So for the people who are perhaps in a scene that's not directly demo coding, maybe give a lay explanation and then expand from there.
Okay, so rendering 101.
All right.
Start with mathematical description of whatever it is you want to draw. And somehow you have to compute the light that is going to be shown on the screen. The simplest thing you can do is just give every surface a single color. But what you end up with is no shadows, no lighting effects. It's just a big blob that's, say, orange. So the next step up is you've got so-called flat shading, where you look at the angle between the surface and the light if it's a flat surface, we're talking just triangles here, right? So they're all planar polygons. It's not anything too fancy. The flat shading, at least you can distinguish now the different sides of an object made out of triangles, but because it's flat, it doesn't look very interesting. It's all just, everything looks like it's just carved out of plastic and it's just sitting there and there's no shadows, there's no subtle lighting or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So Henri Gouraud, who did his PhD at the University of Utah in early 70s, I think he got his in like maybe 73 or something, he said, well, instead of just computing a single reflected light color for the entire triangle, what we'll do is we'll compute three reflected light colors at the three vertices of the triangle, and then for the interior of the triangle, we will linearly interpolate between those three computed reflected intensities. That's Gouraud shading. It's just simple linear interpolation. It's not anything that fancy, but it brings an extra level of realism beyond plain flat shading. Now, Bui Tui Fong, who was here at the same time, also got his PhD at the University of Utah, said, you know, hey, we can go even better than that. Instead of computing three colors and then interpolating between those three colors, what we can do to get a more accurate representation of the reflected light off of a curved surface, like a sphere, is we can interpolate vectors between the three vertices and then compute the light from their interpolated vectors. Now, if you interpolate three colors, that's less work per pixel than it is to compute these interpolated vectors and then compute the light at each pixel from the interpolated vectors. So that's why Fong shading is more expensive than Gouraud shading. And Gouraud shading, in turn, is more expensive than flat shading, because for flat shading, you just compute one color for the entire triangle, and it's just like flood fill. You don't have to do any more computation per pixel. It's computation per triangle. Now, on top of all that stuff that was going on at the University of Utah in the early 70s, you had James Glynn getting his PhD, and he was the first guy to do texture mapping, where you take an image and you interpolate along the triangle coordinates that index the image. These are the texture coordinates. So then you got a few more numbers that you're interpolating across this triangle, and you use those numbers to do basically a table lookup into an image, and then that applies the texture onto the image. It's like taking wallpaper and wrapping it around an object. So he did that. And then he said, hey, you know, we can not only use these textures to look up colors, but we can look up any parameter that we want to map onto the surface of some kind of polygonal object. So we can use those texture maps, instead of them being textures, they can be surface normals. Now, a surface normal is a vector that is perpendicular to the surface of an object. So normally what you do is you just have surface normals at the vertices, and then for the interior of the triangle, you have to kind of come up with some mathematical approximation to figure out what the surface normal would be on the interior of the triangle. And you have to remember now, you have to kind of visualize that the triangle really isn't the real object. The real object is some smoothly varying object like a sphere or a Volkswagen or something like that. It's not really made up out of triangles. The triangles are just what we do to model the object, to approximate it. It's really some kind of smoothly varying thing. So the better you can come up with a representation mathematically that models that smoothness, then the more realistic you can make pictures of smooth objects. So Glynn came up with this idea of saying, yeah, you want smooth objects, but if you look at an orange, it's kind of a sphere, but it's not really a sphere because you've got all these small surface indentations on the skin of the orange. And he said, hey, you know what we can do is we can take a sphere and then we can model that bumpiness of the surface of the skin by using what's called a normal map, where instead of looking up textures or looking up colors from a texture map, you're looking up normals from a normal map. And so he did the first bump mapping, and he made some pictures of an orange and a strawberry, if I remember correctly. Those are the first two bumped mapped objects that were ever rendered, were some pieces of fruit. And along with those guys doing their stuff, there were other guys doing things that were important contributions at the same time. For instance, there's one thing that comes up when you start indexing textures and smacking images onto objects is that there's a big sampling problem in there, that how do you, if you have an image that has a lot of fine detail in it, if you don't do the right things, that fine detail ends up turning into all kinds of aliasing and moiré patterns in the final rendering. this guy Lance Williams, who was also here in the 70s, got his PhD. He wrote a great paper. Lance Williams, I've met him and talked with him. He now works for Disney Imagineering. He's not really like a hardcore computer scientist or a hardcore mathematician. So Lance wrote this paper called Pyramidal Parametrics. And this is the origin of MIP mapping. MIP mapping is a rendering technique that combines textures with the necessary mathematical know-how so that when you magnify or compress a texture, it doesn't result in all kinds of aliasing or moiré artifacts, other kind of rendering artifacts that are undesirable. All of these techniques that I've mentioned, Garreau shading, developed by Henri Garreau, Phong shading, created by Bui-Tui Phong, texture mapping, bump mapping, Jim Blinn also contributed a lighting model, which is a mathematical model of how surfaces reflect light. And most of the ones that we use in computer graphics are absolutely not based in physics. They're based on what can we compute in the time that we have. They're approximations to reality. And there's a famous Jim Blinn quote which says that, you know, the image doesn't have to be real, it just has to look real. And that's the art of demo making right there, is what you've got real-time constraints, you've got to do things fast. You don't have time to go off and ray trace something forever in a day to make it look beautiful. You've got to do what you need to do in the time you need to do it, and you've got no more time than that.
It's the
art of cheating the eye, making something that looks interesting without, you know, really, you know, when you decompose it under the covers, it's really something simple because it has to be in order to be rendered so fast. But that's the art of computer graphics right there, man. It's just making an image that looks interesting or looks believable, even though it's based on a pack of lies when you come down to it. It's not computed from the first rules of physics and, you know, deriving all the whole light reflection stuff. There are people who do that, and there's a lot more of that coming into computer graphics as the hardware gets more powerful, but we still cheat all the time. We approximate stuff. We pretend that objects only consist of surfaces that face us, and the ones that don't face us, we don't draw them because it's just a waste of the computer's time to draw something that isn't visible.
It's a pretty bold claim to say that Salt Lake City, Utah, is the birthplace of computer graphics, but is Salt Lake City, Utah alone in this? Is it pretty much the birthplace of the computer graphics scene, or are there other places that are developing similar technologies at the same time?
It's not like Salt Lake City or University of Utah. It's really University of Utah. It's not like University of Utah is the only place that ever did anything of note.
Right.
But it is the place, man. It's the place where everything came together. David Evans was recruited to form or to head up the computer science department at the University of Utah. And he was specifically given the mission of saying, you need to do something that's world-class that is going to bring recognition to the University of Utah. And he recruited Ivan Sutherland, who had gotten his Ph.D. at MIT, and had gotten his Ph.D. for a project called Sketchpad. Sketchpad was done in 1963. It was the first interactive computer graphics modeling system ever created. And it is, you know, the core. All of the ideas in Sketchpad are the core ideas that we still do today. We just do them with fancier computers that are more powerful, able to handle larger models. They don't have to be wireframe anymore like Sketchpad was. They can be solid objects that we interactively manipulate. But all of the core ideas in every modeling package that exists in the world today originate from Sketchpad. And he was recruited to be a driving force at the department at the University of Utah. And with those two guys, you know, steering the show, they recruited all these people that became the graduate students that invented all of the technology that we use today at the core of it. Now, it's not to say that after those guys, you know, went on to other things after the mid-70s or so, it's not like nobody else ever did anything significant. But if you just go back and look at the core papers of that are considered to be the seminal papers of computer graphics, you'll find that like 60-70% of them are coming from people who got their graduate degree at, you know, PhDs, master's degrees at the University of Utah, late 60s, early 70s, or they have some kind of connection to the University of Utah.
Right.
There are other places that have a significant role in the development of computer graphics. New York Institute of Technology is one of them. But NYIT also had a strong connection to the University of Utah. NYIT's original work, where they were experimenting with the first renderings of color images, with a frame buffer where they were attempting to make a short film. That frame buffer was an Evans and Sutherland frame buffer. It was they were the first company to market a frame buffer ever.
For the people that are listening right now that don't necessarily understand what a frame buffer is, can you explain that?
Yes, please. So the vector displays were like an oscilloscope where you had an electron beam that was controlled in the XY plane. So it was you applied voltages and you deflected this electron beam, and that was how you drew on the screen. But once your models get to a certain level of complexity, you get a lot of flicker on the screen because you can't draw the electron beam fast enough. So they created the frame buffer, which is basically a big chunk of memory, and you index the memory for the XY position of a particular pixel, and you write into the memory a number that represents the intensity. And initially, they just had black and white intensities, and the frame buffers were very low resolution. Every PC today has a frame buffer in the video card.
Right.
You know, everybody's got, you know, we're so used to bitmap graphics now that everybody just kind of takes it for granted, but there was a time before anybody had frame buffers. And so Evans and Sutherland had made a frame buffer. It was a grayscale frame buffer. I think the resolution was only 512 by 512, and it cost like $15,000. And NYIT bought three of them and hooked them up to the red, green, and blue channels of the CRT.
Oh.
And that's how they got the first color frame buffer. And it was, you know, it's like, you know, something now that you can buy at a PC swap market for $5. You can buy a 2D-only video card with a frame buffer that has higher resolution than this thing. And this thing, we're talking, it was like $50,000, and it had its own custom controller, which was a mini computer. I believe it was a PDP-8, or could have been a PDP-11. You know, it had its own dedicated computer that was assigned the task of updating and refreshing the video display from this big memory bank. And you got to remember, in those days, you had only small-density memory chips. So we're probably talking like, you know, for a single frame buffer, it was probably like 6 or 8 cards in a rack, and each of the cards was probably like, you know, the size of an old LP record. I mean, it was probably quite a big honk of piece of equipment when you had it all together.
I was reading a little bit about the history of the Utah Teapot, which is pretty much one of the most famous models that's included as a default, you know, package in almost every 3D modeling, like 3D Studio and 3DS Max and everything like that.
You mentioned modeling, and modeling and rendering. I talked a little bit about rendering with all the different shading techniques.
Right.
And that's the, you know, one part of computer graphics, but the other part is modeling. You can't have an interesting scene unless you have some interesting models in it. And at the University of Utah, there was just as much work done in modeling as there was done in rendering. The first parametrically based face model was done at the University of Utah for facial animation. And what I mean by parametrically is that they would have a slider that, say, went from 0 to 1, and this controlled how much of the mouth was making a smile or a frown or something like that. So they could control the facial expression by manipulating parameters instead of having to go and individually move the vertices around manually. That was a major step forward. Procedural modeling, the first procedural modeling was done here. And procedural modeling, manual modeling, is very labor-intensive. It takes a lot of time to get a 3D digitizer out, record the positions in space of all the points on the surface of an object in a fine enough detail to be able to resolve the important features of that object. Procedural modeling is where you write a piece of code, and the code generates the model directly from executing the code. Sort of the way PostScript renders a page by executing a bunch of code that, as a side effect, results in a printed page. So the first procedural modeling was done at the University of Utah. It was a procedurally modeled chess set. The first attempts to model smooth surfaces with so-called spline equations, that was also done. A lot of that work was also done at the University of Utah. And the very first attempts at modeling real-world objects, such as the Utah teapot, which Martin Newell had sitting on his desk, and he said, you know, hey, this is just kind of a nice-looking teapot. It's got smoothly varying surface to it. It's not just like, you know, a cylinder with a, you know, handle stuck on it and a spout rammed on the end. It's got a nice aesthetic to it. And so he captured that aesthetic of the teapot into some spline patches, each patch representing like a kind of rectangular chunk of the teapot. and he joined all these patches together, and that's the original Teapot data set. And in addition to that, Ivan Sutherland took his class out in the parking lot, and they taped up his Volkswagen bug with a bunch of electrical tape, I believe it was, and they marked out physical patches on his Volkswagen bug, and then they recorded the positions of the different patches that covered the surface and produced a surface model of his Volkswagen. And that model is also floating around on the internet. It's been around for a really long time. So there was a lot of work and modeling that went on, as well as rendering.
At the time that this was being done, I mean, what was the clock speed of these computers, and how were they generating these graphics? Were they generating them on screen or through a plotter or some other output device?
Early on, they probably were using vector-based displays, as I was mentioning. The first product of Evans and Sutherland was a product called the Line Drawing System 1, or the LDS-1, which is kind of an in-joke for the people who live here, because the Mormon Church is also goes by the name of the Church of Latter-day Saints, or LDS,
yeah.
Right? So it's kind of funny that they named it the LDS-1. And this was a line drawing system. It used a vector-based display. It had a display list where you described your object as a bunch of vectors, and then you handed it off to the display processor, and then it would traverse that display list and refresh the image periodically from that display list. So early work was done using these vector-based displays. And then once they started to get the first frame buffers in, which was pretty much coincided with the introduction of color, because it's just very difficult to get any kind of significant color with a vector-based display, they started doing frame buffer renderings, and then from there, you know, you can get an output, a hard copy. Most of the hard copy was obtained by taking photographs of the screen in a controlled environment with a professional photographer. The department had a full-time professional photographer whose job it was to record the output that people generated, usually as still images, sometimes as motion pictures. And these still images would be, you know, they'd have the frame printed up, and then it would, you know, be literally glued into their thesis.
Wow.
And
that's old school screen capturing for you, basically.
Yeah, there was no, I mean, before you had a frame buffer, there wasn't anything you could actually capture as data. You had to take a picture of it, or you had to print it out on a plotter by using a pen-based plotter. So people did that as well. In fact, there was a guy, Ron Resch is his name, and he's more on the artist side of computer graphics than the technology side, which is what I always find interesting about computer graphics, is that it brings the artists and the technologists together in a common vocabulary, common goal, common desires. But Ron's more of an artist, and he made the world's largest Ukrainian Easter egg. It's about like 70 feet in diameter, and it's like 180 feet long, and it's up at this, it's in Canada, mounted on a pedestal, and it's a polygonal surface, and the surface triangles are different colors because you just anodize these aluminum plates with different anodization processes, and you get different colors out of it, different shades. And the reason I bring that up is that the triangular panels themselves were actually manufactured on a modified plotter, where they took the plotting pen and replaced it with a scoring instrument, and they scored these sheets of anodized aluminum with the plotter by writing a program that would like trace the triangle out like over and over and over to score the metal, and then they would manually break the trim off to get the remaining piece, and then they hauled all these up to a town in Canada where there's a bunch of Ukrainian immigrants, and assembled it on site, and they didn't even know, they hadn't even ever tested assembled it, you know, before they got there. So it was kind of a risky thing, but
right.
They pulled it all together. If you search if you Google for world's largest Ukrainian Easter egg, you can find pictures of that.
I'm going to get right on that.
That might have been done like in 68 or something. That was done quite some time ago. Ron Resch is a really interesting character.
Cool.
Spinsane has had a couple beers tonight, so...
What do you mean?
The clanking of beer bottles.
Sorry.
It's all right, man.
Listening.
He had to make room to get to the keyboard so he could Google for that.
Yeah.
I was Googling for Pilgrimage the whole time.
So tickets for Pilgrimage 2004 will be going on sale tomorrow, June 14th, Monday. And pay for those via PayPal. They'll be $20 per person up until, when is the early bird deadline for ticket
August
sales?
August 14th.
Very cool. Legalize, thank you very much for being a part of the Arts Radio Show. I appreciate you taking time out of your personal life to share this history of the computer graphics origins with us. It was very enlightening.
My pleasure.
Have a good evening, dude.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Once again, that was Legalize, organizer of the Pilgrimage Demo Party, speaking in paragraph form on the history of 3D computer graphics. For more information on the Pilgrimage Demo Party, you can find that on their website at pilgrimage.scene.org. Were they beer bottles?
No, they were Coke bottles.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So what else has been going on with you? You've taken a little vacation from the arts. What have you been doing? What else have you been up to? Working on the Remorse 54 pack? Or?
Yeah, I'm getting the Remorse 54 pack ready, dealing with the ASCII ANSI scene, which you don't have to deal with because you're retired.
That's right, dude. I am quote-unquote retired.
We got a new member in Remorse, just Speed Devil fucking submitted 19 pieces, man. Like, that's a lot. And I got like 10 or 11 myself, so.
I just purchased my tickets to Finland just recently, last Tuesday.
I heard this on the Remorse, on some kind of anonymous email list, and I asked you how much they cost, and the verdict is?
The verdict was that I paid $1,100, actually I paid $1,143 per ticket, not including tax and whatever other fees that they include per ticket. And what I learned from that is don't always take, you know, the price that you find on Orbitz and Priceline at face value. The reason that I purchased my tickets sooner rather than later was, as everybody knows, at least here in the U.S., gas prices have been skyrocketing. And, you know, it's constantly on the news, and it always happens every summer anyhow. But they're, you know, extraordinarily high right now, at least for us. And there's been, you know, rumor that this is going to, if gas prices are rising for us, then that's also going to surely be impacting the cost of jet fuel, and then, you know, that will filter down to us and affect the airfare prices, right?
Well, so, yeah. I mean, I've been actually checking the business section of the local paper at work, you know. I guess a lot of the airplane franchises are trying to raise the price of tickets because of the gasoline prices, but fortunately, it doesn't seem like the other airplane companies have been raising the prices.
I've been monitoring the prices of the airline tickets for several months because I've been planning this event. You know, we're going to have the ACID reunion there, the ACID European reunion there.
In Finland, right?
Yes. So I've been monitoring prices actually for about 2 years. Just recently I was able to do specific pricing to the specific date that I had in mind, and they've gone up a little bit, not too much, but the point that I was making was, you know, don't take the cost that you're seeing on the discount brokers such as Orbitz and Priceline at face value, because Priceline was quoting me something in order of like $1,500, and Orbitz was popping up with different varying prices. It just kind of depended on how I performed the search. Oddly enough, the more specific of a search that I would make, sometimes I would find a cheaper price than if I were to make a more generalized search for the same date, which kind of, well, that struck me as odd. But when I actually contacted the airline that I had in mind to fly on and asked them what kind of price they could provide me with, they also quoted me a high price in the, you know, she said, please hold while I find the lowest fare for you. And she quoted me some price, you know, for $1,400. And I said, you know, I'm able to obtain this for much, you know, for a much lower price on Orbitz.
Right.
And I gave her the flight numbers, and she wasn't able to book all of the flight numbers for me personally. So we had to switch to some alternate airlines. And then when she did that, using some of the original flight numbers that I provided her with, we actually wound up with a flight that was lower than what was on Orbitz.
That's interesting.
That's very interesting. I find a couple things interesting about that. One is that, you know, you can't just take the person on the other phone, you can't just take their word that they're finding you the lowest fare, because she's on the phone typing away for like 5 minutes plus, you know, entering all my flight data and saying, you know, here's the lowest fare I can find for you. And then we're able to, you know, beat it by several hundred dollars.
Hmm. So how's it going for the pilgrimage flight? Is that
pilgrimage airfare is it's very reasonable here because I'm on the West Coast. So you should be able to fly out of pretty much any airport for around $2.
Right.
So it's not a problem. Not
but
a problem.
Flying internationally is proving to be a little bit more of a problem.
It's much more pricey since I'm on the West Coast. If I was on the East Coast, it would be substantially cheaper, and if it was during an off-peak month, unfortunately, you know, June, July, August are considered the peak travel months for Europe. I had a, let's see, just today, actually, I got to meet former Acid member and musician. I believe he was, well, he's in Chill right now, Chill Productions. Intense, formerly known as Sonic, who was, while he was in Acid, he was an anti-Ansimation legend. I mean, really, personally, in my own personal opinion, second to Jed, he is one of the best. Sonic is quite infamous for his renderings of Force 10. He made several Force 10 anti-animations. So anyways, got to meet him today. We got to hang out, have a barbecue. He's recently moved out from Manhattan to the West Side.
Cool.
I'm glad to have him over here.
Oh, shit. I know you're talking about your boys who are, like, coming back and stuff and that. But, other radio shows.
Definitely. Yeah. Other radio shows.
You wanted to talk about those.
Like, yeah. You know, we're not alone in this. We may have mentioned this in a previous episode, that we are not the only radio show out there. There's several other internet radio shows that are being broadcast all the time. Notably, there's BinRev, Binary Revolution. What are some of the other radio shows that you find yourself listening to these days?
Well, my friend, like you, this radio show started from me listening to
Actually,
other radio shows. The first one was Radio Freak America.
Right, RFA.
Yeah, which is gone, which is dead.
Right, they released, what, 100 or 99 episodes?
99. But that was oldschoolfreak.com. School is spelled S-K-O-O-L. The other show I've been listening to recently that is pretty good, I've been listening to a lot, actually, like Uberlito, DTMF.org. You don't need us to find their links. But a show that has been good is Default Radio. That was hot. The most important show, like, we're just listing off shows that we've both listened to at this point, but the most important one that I've listened to recently is The Afternow, Tales from the Afternow.
Tales from the Afternow. I haven't heard that yet, but you've been talking a lot about it.
It's very good, dude. You should really listen to it.
What kind of subjects does it focus on?
It's almost like all these shows that we've discussed, and including our show. All these shows that we've discussed up to this point are reality shows, basically, where you talk about hacking, freaking, logical stuff that happens. But The Afternow, what it is, kind of like a cyberpunk, liberal arts show.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you've read the book Neuromancer,
right.
Have you not?
Of course.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like Neuromancer, but updated for 21st century, because the technology in Neuromancer, which I read, you know, years ago, is kind of outdated. Basically, it's like a Neuromancer that is written and read radio dramatic without all the problems in Neuromancer coming through. So it's basically like a real live version of a cyberpunk novel.
So it's a storytelling radio show?
Yes, it is.
So it's not necessarily like most of the other shows that we've previously mentioned are talk radio shows.
It's not like any of those. And, like,
okay.
I wouldn't give it props if I didn't find it as important as I found it.
Okay, so it's something you enjoy. I'll have to check it out.
Yep.
You've definitely been raving about it recently. Yeah, all the shows that we've mentioned, they can be downloaded at audio.textfiles.com. Jason Scott hosts an archive of all of these shows that we've mentioned. As well as, if you want to keep tabs on when these are coming out and make comments to the people who are hosting these shows, you can go to the BinRev forums at www.binrev.com/forums.
Yeah.
And they have one of their message areas there is hackradio/TV. And that's basically where people post notes about the latest episodes that are coming out. And you can keep tabs on all of that.
Yeah, they're good people.
I think that's all I have. We're running out of time here. We're going to close out the show with music by Melody of Five Musicians.
Oh, I was waiting for that, man.
Yes, from the Blur Green music disc.
Oh, I'm going to rave out.
All right, buddy.
All right, peace.
Well, have a good night.
All right, you too.